The Cinema Arts Center of Huntington, New York invites you to their annual African American Film Festival, Friday, April 28th through Thursday, May 4th. The theme of this year's festival is Faces of Change, as film artists inspire others to transform their communities and bring about change across the world. Featured films include Chisholm 72, Mandalay, Sisters-in-Law, Brother to Brother, Street Fight, The Boys of Baraka, Herbie Hancock's Possibilities, and of course, Faces of Change. There'll also be special guest speakers throughout the festival. For more information, call 631-423-7611. That's 631-423-7611.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. It's just about 7 o'clock, and you know what that means. It means this machine's not going to work. It means it's time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you tonight, joined by Bernie S. in Philadelphia.
Good evening, from Philadelphia.
Got you first this time.
Yeah.
Jim over here in New York.
Hello.
And we've got Mike.
Hi.
And Redbird.
Good evening.
Arseny.
Hi.
Walter.
Hey.
And Seraph joins us this week.
Hello.
So we have all kinds of fun things to talk about tonight. Interesting news developments. Actually, I don't know if you guys heard this. You might have heard me talking about it, but very good news. BBC World has now come to the New York metropolitan area. I imagine quite a few of you in this particular room might be affected. You guys have Cablevision? No?
Time Warner.
Time Warner?
Yeah.
Arseny?
No, I have DirecTV and Dish Network.
Walter, how about you?
Yeah, I have...
Well, I know you don't have it. You're in Pennsylvania.
Well, no, I have Comcast here in Philadelphia, but I am able to catch the snippets of... BBC World on the evenings on WHYY.
Yeah, you know what? It's not the same thing.
I agree. I want it 24/7.
Uh huh. Well, yeah, 24/7.
Because I've already called Comcast and said I want my BBC World 24/7.
And now you can point to Cablevision, who are carrying it on channel 104 of all their systems in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And I have to say, it's probably because listeners out there were bitching and moaning about it, which is what we need you to do sometimes, to bitch and moan about things, so that we can improve our lot. And what we have from this, we have a different perspective of the world, and that's always a good thing. So congratulations to Cablevision people. Maybe we can get it on Time Warner now. And
what do
places.
You get on the 24-hour feed that you don't get from the snippets that they play on, for example, WLIW?
Well, you get all sorts of documentaries about all kinds of world events. You get an online show called Click. It used to be called Click Online. You get a documentary program called Reporters, where reporters all over the world take you to different interesting places and show you what it's like to gather news stories. You get Hard Talk, which is one of the best programs ever, where they just kind of broil somebody over an open flame and ask them all these questions for a half hour without stopping. And we're talking about world leaders, we're talking about famous people, we're talking about activists, talking about anybody that is a mover or shaker in the world today. they're brought onto that program, and they can't leave.
I always wonder why people choose to go on shows like that.
I don't know. I think a lot of the Americans go on those shows because they don't know what they are, because they've never seen them, because they're not aired in this country. But, you know, they'll have an American leader on there, and they'll be relentless with the questions. Like, how can you honestly expect people to believe the things that you're saying? They'll ask questions like that. You cannot get away with that in this country. You're allowed to say these things, but nobody ever does. So it's the same thing as if it were forbidden.
Manuel.
Yes.
At the same time, while we can celebrate that BBC World is being rebroadcast here on or simulcast here in the U.S. in some limited markets, it's a at the same time, just a week ago, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that said the BBC has reviewed its strategy for the past year on broadcasting and decided that, I'm going to quote it here, it says, after a year-long review of its strategy, the BBC, the world's biggest and best-known public broadcaster, said it plans to put more resources into its already large Internet presence and no longer regards itself primarily as a producer of television and radio. And I just wanted to say that it's a sad day when the BBC says its future in broadcasting or radio broadcasting is limited, because since 1922 the BBC has brought a fairly balanced view of world events to listeners around the world on shortwave and other mediums, and it has drastically cut back its broadcasts on mediums other than the Internet over the past few years, specifically on shortwave, which it no longer broadcasts in North America. It doesn't mean you can't hear it in North America. You just have to pick up feeds to other countries in North America. You can still hear it on shortwave in North America, but you have to try harder.
You have to be lucky, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a good development. I think shortwave, unlike the Internet medium, doesn't involve intermediaries or middlemen that have to bring that content to you. Radio, as we all know, because it's a radio show, is a unique medium in that it's directly from the transmitter to the recipient without anybody in the middle who can interfere with that content delivery.
Well, I wonder, when they're saying that they don't see themselves as having as much of a future in broadcasting, are they perhaps also saying that broadcasting itself may not have that much of a future?
Well, I don't know. They just said they no longer regard themselves primarily as a producer of television and radio. And mm-hmm. I think they're in the past three, 4 years, they've been shifting their eggs into the whole Internet scheme as a way to get their content out. And I think that's a mistake. I don't think that should, obviously, I don't think it should omit the Internet, but I think that actual broadcasting, where there's no one in the middle that can shut off the content between the transmitter and the recipient, I don't think that should be ignored. I think that's a valuable, whether it's television or radio, I think it's a valuable medium where you can't have intermediaries shutting off that content.
Well, I think that basically it's all summed up in the second paragraph of this Wall Street Journal story we're looking at. The London-based BBC, founded in 1922, said it plans to offer a service on its website similar in some respects to MySpace.com.
Oh, no.
I mean, my God, this is the BBC. That's the most embarrassing statement I think they've made in decades. They actually want to do something, anything, similar to MySpace.com. For God's sake, people, you're the BBC. Act like it.
Unfortunately, MySpace is very popular, so that's where that's coming from. But
well, all sorts of things are popular, but it doesn't mean you have to do them.
No,
I think Alistair Cook, who brought us for many decades, is wonderful and beautiful narratives called A Letter from America on shortwave. He's probably rolling over to his grave right now. He's passed away last year. And anyone who's been lucky enough to hear his narratives over the years has really come to know America in a different perspective. And I'm sure some of those recordings are online if you just do.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And incidentally, I don't think he's rolling over in his grave, because didn't somebody steal his bones?
It's more like that. It's just almost insulting to his legacy. So I encourage any listeners who are not familiar with Alistair Cook's narratives on his Letter from America piece from it was available really I think daily or weekly from the BBC.
It was a weekly thing, and it lasted for about maybe 20-25 minutes of him just pontificating on various things happening in the news that week, and it was always fascinating to listen to. Many's the time I stayed in my car listening long after I should have gotten out just to hear how it all ended. Okay, interesting developments there. This is something that we got mailed to us 100,000 times, but it's, I guess it's kind of funny. A case of electronic vandalism mocking the Prime Minister of Canada has left a media company red-faced after a hacker tampered with advertising signs on Toronto commuter trains to read, "Stephen Harper Eats Babies." Stephen Harper, of course, is the Prime Minister, and I'm reading the story from the Toronto Globe and Mail. So when they describe that as what a hacker does, they're the ones saying that, not me. So I'm just reading the story here. We can debate this, though. Go Transit officials promised to block further insults on its trains. Yeah, no more insulting on the trains. A digital security expert said the proliferation of electronic signs that are programmed with internet connections makes this kind of digital tampering as easy as buying a $23.95 gadget, and more of it should be expected. The note first popped up on Thursday on one of two narrow scrolling signs that are installed in each of the rail system's 395 cars. Why is this? This is the same thing that happened in New York City back in 1997. Why is this a story? Why is it making so many headlines? Someone simply walked up to one of these things with a remote control unit and reprogrammed it. No computer hacking, nothing more nefarious than someone simply pointing something at something else, typing in a few words, and being on their way.
Was that it, or was it internet controlled? I didn't get that.
The comment by the person who was quoted there in that story manual is really oxymoronic. On a phrase, the access to these signs typically has nothing to do with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with their infrared programming capability, which can be done with as the guy does refer to, a 2395 device that can be used to. If you find out who made this electronic sign and find out, look up on their website. Usually, there's a keyboard you can buy that sends the infrared commands to the display, and typically that's what people use to hack these signs, not an internet connection.
Right.
So this guy's comment is really oxymoronic.
Well, there are a couple of really super moronic things in here, too. They give an explanation which is fairly accurate, I think. Normally, the advertisements and community notices slated for the signs, which carry text using light-emitting diodes, LEDs, are transferred from a computer to a handheld device called a loader. No internet involved. The computer, though, might be able to transfer the actual message. Train staff then take the loaders to each sign on board and transmit the messages using wireless technology. The loaders can transmit from as far away as 4 meters. And the only reason they do that is so they don't have to keep retyping the same message over and over again. Now, company officials figure that the hacker got his or her hands on a loader, which can be purchased online for as little as $23.95. And if somebody up in Toronto tells us who makes these signs, as Bernie said, the name of it will be written on there.
According to the Toronto Star, these devices can even be bought at Sam's Club.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but
so
if we know,
no need to go online at all.
If we know the name of the company, we can tell you exactly where these can be gotten. It's very easy to prevent too. You simply cover up well, then of course they can't program it either.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what they could do? This is a radical thought. They could put a password on these things, because guess what? The Go Transit sign system does not require a password, according to the president of Executive Advertising. And they own and operate about 800 signs along the commuter routes. Now, I got a copy of a memo from Exclusive Advertising that basically says this. It's dated May 1st regarding Stephen Harper LED message. Exclusive Advertising has received reports of an LED message being displayed on the trains stating that Stephen Harper eats babies. We, in all caps, too, by the way. We would like to take the opportunity to advise the public that these ads are the result of a hacker who has unlawfully tampered with the LED signboards displayed in Nico trains. This message was in no way authorized by Executive Advertising or Go Transit and is not condoned. We have taken measures to rectify this matter and are in the process of enhancing security in an effort to eliminate tampering of the LED displays. Read, install a password.
I don't know. It's more than installing a password. They're having special software couriered from the United States.
Yeah, software that supports passwords. Let me finish with the memo here. We would like to thank everyone who has taken the time to bring this matter to our attention. It must have been deluged with phone calls. And would ask that anyone with information on the person or persons responsible for this malicious act to contact us immediately so that we can pursue legal action. We sincerely apologize for this unfortunate situation and thank everyone for their patience while the matter is resolved. Signed, Greg Donahue, President. My God, I mean, this is the equivalent of graffiti. Someone simply tamper with a sign. Get on with your lives. Do some software installation if it's that important to you. And get on with it.
The problem is...
Well, I was going to say that I read something similar, and the system did have passwords, except this very intelligent individual bypassed the system. This is what happened. He saw a sign, like a road sign, that had LEDs, and he went up to it curiously, and he noticed that the panel that like controls it was open, the keypad, and it said enter password. So he looked up, and the password was written in black Sharpie on the keypad, and he typed it in and then changed the message. And he did this like to a number of signs, and they all had the password written right on them.
Oh, that's your human interaction there.
Just one bit of clarification. There's this guy, Jerry Nichols, who's one of the most offended people, apparently. He wants us to know that he worked with Stephen Harper for 5 years, and never once did he in that time actually eat a baby.
Well, that's good to know.
It's good to know.
One of the problems is a lot of these devices don't have password functionality because it's assumed that you have to be there and you have to actually have the device capable of programming it, not overlooking the fact that you can just purchase one of these programmers.
Well, that's a pretty big fact to overlook. But let me finish with the news story here because a couple other fun facts that aren't really true. Well, this guy says there's actually a whole slew of ways to hack into these signs, which I guess is probably somewhat true. The LED signs vary in terms of technology, but if the device were connected to the Internet, it would require only that a hacker determine the sign's Internet protocol address by scanning millions of computers, a simple task for hackers.
But you don't connect signs on trains to the Internet. It would be much more trouble than it's worth.
If you're a moron, you might try that.
Well, okay.
Then they would need a default name and password for the system. Well, then I guess you do need a name and password, even though it's a default. Many manufactured products use default passwords because the manufacturers still don't think that someone could easily hack in. Nevertheless, this expert said this is what hackers do every day. And here's a thing that really annoys me. For example, in Europe, hackers have used Internet technology to get into the overhead lights inside office buildings, darkening or illuminating windows to mimic computer games such as Tetris, which asks players to rotate and then stack falling shapes. Other systems that are connected to the Internet include traffic lights and power grids. Now, in that same paragraph, they've implied that people who play with the office lights, like the blinking lights project, are also playing with traffic lights and power grids. They don't even bother to say that project over in Germany was done in cooperation with the owners of the building. Good Lord.
And it's not even like they used the stock lights in there. They had spotlights that they installed specifically for this purpose, and they were shined right on the I think they had nice little white shades or something that they shine the lights onto.
Well, all the signs have been shut down. They don't say anything right now. It's incredible how something so trivial, so just a little prank, turns into something where people are freaking themselves out, that the power grid and traffic lights and all kinds of anarchy is on the way.
And I got to say, Emmanuel, that the allegation this is like graffiti is not even close to the truth. Because graffiti generally involves having to scrub off particles off of some surface, whatever. This doesn't damage or put any particles on anything. Somebody can just easily reprogram the sign, and it's all done with. There's no damage or defacement of anything. So it's just the stupidity of the company that operates the signs, whoever that is, to duly protect it from the most rudimentary programming that is the reason for this. Not someone who would want to willfully damage anything.
I hope that our friends in Germany are listening, especially anyone involved with blinking lights. Please contact the Toronto, the Globe and Mail, and ask them to print a retraction and correction, because, they've impugned your morality and your criminality, your lack of criminality, by implying that blinking lights was an illegal hack, an illegal act.
Yeah. They haven't mentioned Chaos Computer Club by name, but certainly anybody who has looked into this will see something. They'll see, blinking lights, illegal, so therefore it must be something bad. And that's just not fair. Okay, moving on. Interesting developments. Suffolk County, New York, out on Long Island, is planning a wireless system to provide free access to the Internet to the 1.5 million residents who live throughout its 900 square miles. It would be one of the largest government-sponsored wireless networks in the nation. The system would allow anyone to use computers and PDA devices with wireless capabilities anywhere in the county. It would also be available to visitors, businesses, government agencies, institutions, and groups. County officials hope to start installation of this next year. According to County Executive Steve Levy, people could connect to the Internet anytime, any place. A private company selected by the county would build the system at no cost to taxpayers and finance it by selling internet advertising or by charging a fee for connections with a faster speed. I thought this was an incredible story. And then later on in the week, Rhode Island announced that they are seeking to become the first entire state to offer a wireless broadband network from border to border. It would cost $20 million to do this. Now, the question I have is this even possible to be able to get wireless connectivity to an entire state or an entire county?
The thing that gets me is that I know of, this hasn't even been done successfully in a small city to completely cover it, where the infrastructure is there, where you can put access points on buildings all over the place that already have internet connectivity and get it to actually work throughout the whole city. So for a county like Suffolk County, where there's a lot of spread out space and places that I'm sure that internet connectivity doesn't even exist, I don't even think this is at all reasonable.
There are places on Long Island we can't get phone service. I mean, wireless phone service. They've pretty much gotten the wired phones to everybody now, but electricity is pretty much covered. But yeah, I mean, how can they manage Wi-Fi if they can't manage digital cell phones?
Now, there are technologies other than Wi-Fi. There's the so-called WiMAX and some of the technologies that the mobile phone carriers are offering that do have the possibility to enable internet access over large swaths of territory, and these articles are never very clear on what sort of technologies exactly Rhode Island or Suffolk County is planning to use, but it seems pretty clear that Wi-Fi wouldn't work.
Well, $20 million for an entire state seems like a very low price to me.
It's a good deal.
WiMAX or whatever. I mean, do you think this is going to happen?
Well, Philadelphia is planning on spending at least $10 million, and I'm sure that'll go over budget several times, just to outfit its tiny geographical coverage area. Just the city of Philadelphia alone is going to cost well over $10 million. So I don't know how you can cover the entire state of, or the entire Suffolk County, or for that matter, the whole state of Rhode Island for $20 million. It's just totally unrealistic. And Wi-Fi is just not the technology that can do that in rural areas. And the technologies that Mike had mentioned, like EVDO and so forth that Verizon and Sprint PCS use to bring reasonable speed internet access to mobile devices is not free. It's very expensive, and there's no way that a city or a state is going to offer that for free or at a tiny cost to its citizens. So
we're saying we're skeptical of this, right?
Yes,
to say the least.
But if it were possible, it would be a good thing, right?
It could be done, but you know, you've got too many vested interests here that are interested in milking the public, it's just no way that a statewide internet access can be offered for free. I would like that to be the case, but I'm trying to be pragmatic here and say it ain't going to happen.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's nice, but the other thing is, like, why? It's such a privacy issue because they can, like, track you. And it's like, what is the benefit, really, is what I'm – why would everyone want this?
Well, because I could plant myself in the middle of the interstate and the median and just check my email if I wanted to.
Well, I mean, you could listen to, like, internet radio in your car. I think that would be really cool.
That would be cool. That'd be great.
But, I mean, aside from that,
I think there's a lot of benefits. I think there's, you know, this could really be beneficial, especially for those who aren't necessarily able to afford it otherwise. But just the practicality of it, and like you said, there's not even cell phone coverage all over Suffolk County. And to expect that a Part 15 service is going to be able to cover the entire county is just not realistic.
What's the benefit to Suffolk County as a government to provide this to people?
It takes attention off, like, various scandals that are taking place right now.
Right. What do they have to gain from that?
I smell a 25% tax.
Well, now, it's interesting because you might have heard in that story that there was a possibility of charging money for higher speeds. And that kind of brings us into this this whole discussion of net neutrality. In fact, a listener wrote in asking us to talk about this. Reports I've heard say Larry H. Say losing net neutrality will all but destroy the freewheeling nature of the Internet. Do you agree? If so, what can we do to preserve it? Now, of course, net neutrality is basically something that we've gotten used to. We haven't really talked about it until we actually are starting to fear that it might not be around much longer.
Can I answer the second question?
Okay, answer the second quote. Why don't you explain what net neutrality is?
Well, the question was, what can we do to... I'll answer that afterwards. The question was, what can we do to preserve it? And the answer seems to be, like, move to France. But in the net neutrality is this notion, which we have on the Internet. It's a part of the Internet that sort of all data is treated more or less equally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm sending a file over to Emmanuel, or if I'm getting it from AOL, you know, it's all the internet, it's all just bits. You know, I may have different access speeds, but no content has any sort of priority over any other content. What a lot of the telecoms are realizing is, hey, we can make more money by charging AOL sort of premium access to our subscribers, so that content from the big providers will be prioritized over that from the smaller providers, with the sort of inevitable effect that some of this content from the smaller providers will not get delivered at all, or will be so slow as to be useless, or what have you. And this hasn't really been done, this sort of prioritizing by willingness to pay. And so these companies are trying to start it, and there's proposals in Congress, which don't seem to be going anywhere very quickly, to make it illegal.
To make this kind of prioritizing illegal?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, because all data should be treated equally.
Emmanuel?
Yes.
An analogy just came to my mind. It'd be like if there was a 3 or 4 lane highway, just for non-technical listeners, if there's like a 3 or 4 lane highway, a toll highway, like a turnpike or something, where you paid one fee for one lane, and then you paid increasingly higher fees to use other lanes. So, like, you couldn't pass anybody unless you paid an extra fee, until you had to really pay a lot of money to be in the leftmost lane. That would be a good analogy to what some of these internet service providers like Verizon are trying to pull off.
So basically, people would be going really slow and paying less and polluting even more.
Well, paying what they're paying now, but having to pay several times that or a lot more just to you know, do what they've been used to doing, which is just pass the slow vehicle, which isn't done really with your knowledge when you're on the internet. Packets sort of get to you in due time and, in a reasonable amount of speed. But if your packets are tagged by your internet service provider as being not worthy of being delivered to you at a reasonable speed, then you're going to be in the slow lane.
Yeah, one way that I see this really affecting the internet is in changing the whole way that competition works and stifling the kind of innovation and healthy competition that's gotten us the good things that we've gotten out of the internet so far. If you have something like, say, Google Video, which is pretty dominant right now, mainly because it's put out by Google and people are aware of it and lured towards it, let's say I come up with a better video service than Google Video, people might never even see it because Google Video is owned by Google, and Google has the kind of money to pay the ISPs that you and I use every day to deliver that content quickly. I come along, I make a better product. Mm-hmm. It may be a better product, but it won't matter because it will load so slowly.
And it's like, draw another parallel, distribution of music. If you have a record contract in the old system, you were heard. If you didn't, nobody knew who you were, even if you were great.
And another, I think, realistic viewpoint on this stuff is, for example, you have a provider like Verizon, and if they implement the infrastructure to flag different types of packets as having priority over others, they can very easily flag some types of voice over IP traffic as being less priority, and basically render a lot of the VoIP technology that we use now to make internet phone calls useless.
One other important thing, I think, to realize about this is that the technology to do this really already exists and is in place. It's called quality of service, and it's used in many other places for perfectly good reasons, but it is not currently in use for this kind of application. And so one thing to think about is that if the ISPs do decide to go ahead with a plan like this, there are no big technical hurdles to overcome. It's merely a matter of implementing the policy.
The best analogy I heard is imagine a library like the Library of Congress where you don't actually go to the stacks. You have to order it through a desk. Currently, you can order anything you want, and the librarian, so-called, will get it for you. Under this system, certain things will be delayed. You'll have to wait longer. It may be because of content, or it may be simply for non-payment, but the point is, you'll never really know. Whereas now, you can get anything you want, and there's no censorship or even evidence of censorship Whereas in the other way, they may say it's for monetary reasons, they didn't pay for access, but you'll never know.
And even for certain applications, it can become the point where the application is completely useless, such as voice over IP, which depends on UDP packets getting there right away. So it's just.
And one of the saddest things about all of this, too, is that the people who want to put this in place, which are the ISPs who serve the end users, are not getting any kind of bad deal in the position that they're in right now. They're incredibly profitable. They're doing fine. Nobody's losing any money. They just smell a new revenue source, and they're willing to screw all of their end users out of their proper Internet experience just to find another revenue stream.
Some things never change. Okay, this story, you might have heard this about this most dangerous computer hacker in the world. No, it's not Kevin Mitnick anymore. Alleged hacker Gary McKinnon has accused the United States of using a hammer to squash a gnat, and that's in front of his May 10th extradition hearing. He said to the media, "What I did was just unauthorized access. I'm pissed off that 6 months community service has turned out to be 60 years in a foreign jail." McKinnon claimed that there is often an overreaction in cases of hacking that do not match the level of the supposed crime. "I did not do any damage. Basically, I just was looking in military systems and things like that." It's just like when Matthew Bevin was arrested in 1995. They called him the biggest threat to national security since Hitler. What a load of rubbish. I've only seen a few cases where the reaction has been in good ratio to the crime, such as the Citibank case. I believe that was the case involving Russians many years ago who were actually stealing money. That was the theft in, he explains it now, the theft in hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it was all down to organized crime in Russia in the end. The decision on whether McKinnon is extradited will be made at the May 10th hearing, and he rates his chances at 50-50. "I'm worried. I know I have got a big fight on my hands." While his case has been going on, McKinnon has questioned the whole extradition procedure America is using. The new extradition treaty, which isn't ratified by the U.S. Senate yet, is a one-ended treaty. It's also retrospective, which is against international treaty laws. It's also meant to be a fast track for combating terrorism, but it's being used for people like me, people in finance, lots of businessmen. The U.S. administration is completely misusing the law. What do you think, Barney? Sounds familiar, huh?
It does sound familiar, and not just in my own case, but I found that the feds typically try to stretch things, stretch of a stretch of a stretch, to accomplish their goals. And in this case, it sounds like that the Patriot Act and some other legislation are being used to apply serious issues like extraditing someone from another country into your jurisdiction for something that's a relatively minor offense, like exposing some poor security on a military computer server or something like that. But on the topic of courts in the U.S., I just want to interject here today that. It was interesting that today a jury had the courage to find someone not sentenceable to death in this country, Zachary Massawi. I'm not going to make any judgments about what he did or intended to do, but I think it's interesting that a jury had the courage to actually find someone, spare someone's life and not sentence them to death for something they intended to do.
Well, it's one way to really annoy a potential suicide bomber is to make him live for the rest of his life behind bars.
Yeah, he wanted to be a martyr, and I'm glad they did not make him one.
About the McKinnon case, first, shouldn't, when he says retrospective, shouldn't that be retroactive? Secondly, what country is he in? And thirdly, what did he do? Do we know?
Okay, well, continuing, he's in England, or the UK, I believe. Interesting story. He was looking into UFOs. So there's a whole story behind what he was actually looking for. What he says about his chances after the May 10th hearing, obviously he's has a 50-50 chance in his eyes. His biggest fear is that the U.S. feels it can hold people in Guantanamo Bay who aren't even accused of attacking the U.S. "I won't stand a chance in hell if I get extradited because I will probably come under military order number one. This means a secret military tribunal with a military lawyer, no rights of appeal, no rights of public comment, and no press. It'll be Gary goes down a black hole and you don't see him again." I like this guy. I like the way he just takes on the issues and doesn't keep quiet. According to McKinnon, the top military brass claims that it's where he's been and what he's seen that poses the threat. McKinnon has always asserted that he was hacking to discover the truth about UFOs, and while he's a free man, he is happy to discuss his findings. I was looking for suppressed technology and UFOs, he said. I'd read a book by Stephen Greer called Disclosure that has expert testimonies ranging from civilian air traffic controllers and military radar operators right up to the guys who are in charge of whether or not to launch nuclear missiles. He claims that he found secret files on the Johnson Space Center's systems, including unprocessed and unfiltered photos in a proprietary NASA image format. He describes a cigar-shaped object surrounded by domes, which looked like it was made from a single piece of metal without any seams. And
wow.
I wish he had copied it. Well, maybe he did.
I don't, yeah.
You seem to be skeptical of this, too.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Uh-huh. Well, do you think he was looking for UFOs? Or
oh,
something
maybe
else?
He was looking for UFOs. People are always looking for all kinds of things, but...
Mm-hmm. He sounds pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But just because he's looking for UFOs, he sounds crazy, huh?
Well, that's not a reason to send him to Guantanamo Bay, but...
Well, imagine, just, you know, imagine if you believe that something like that exists and it's in this computer and you know how to get in. Aren't you just a little bit tempted to see what's actually there?
Well, I mean, the issue here is whether or not the punishment fits the crime, and obviously it doesn't, so...
Of course, people will say, well, he invaded the privacy of the military, so obviously he has to be strung up for that.
Well, that clearly will not be the legal argument used, because there's no real privacy rights of any sort in the United States.
Yeah, but the military and the government seem to have a lot of protection.
Oh, they have secrecy.
The public should actually be outraged at this because the security on these military systems were so easy to defeat. And if it becomes a matter of national security, our government's not doing what it takes to protect, you know, these servers.
There's a difference, too, between privacy and secrecy. Individuals have privacy. Mm. The government has secrecy.
Good point.
Well, this is more reason for them to just give him a job there.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, we're assuming that he does have some semblance of sanity and that's what he was, in fact, doing, and it wasn't something else. But it's an interesting story. And I do see remnants of Bernie S. and Kevin Mitnick and Fiber Optic in the exaggeration that I perceive here as to what this guy could possibly have done. If the system is secure, he shouldn't be able to get into it at all, and somehow I doubt that he was as much of a threat as they seem to be making out. Okay, we're going to take phone calls, 212-209-2900. That's our phone number. First, a couple of listener letters. Actually, Bernie, this is something you... you sent to us concerning, we were talking about BBC World before, you mentioned that they regularly warn viewers that the following piece contains pictures of flash photography. What did you make out of all that?
Yeah, it was very strange. Last week I was watching a piece on BBC World an evening about Berlusconi not resigning. I'm glad he finally did. But there was a video clip of Berlusconi walking through a crowd of people, and everybody was taking pictures, and there were flashes. But the announcer warned that the piece contained flash images, flash photography. The following pictures contain flash photography. It sounded like a standard message warning they had to give. And I'm like, what is that all about? So I looked it up online on the BBC website. Just do a web search for BBC and flash photography, and you'd probably find a piece that says flashing images. In order to comply with BBC editorial guidelines on the use of flashing images, all recorded programs will need to pass a technical review before being accepted for broadcast. At that review, all programs will be tested using a flash and pattern analyzer device calibrated to register the OFCOM, acronym, recognized standard of safe levels for those suffering from photosensitive epilepsy, TSE. The editorial justification for including a non-compliant sequence of flashing images will only be used in the most exceptional of circumstances and only after a mandatory referral to the commissioning editor. It is not possible just to issue a warning that a program contains strobe lighting or flash photography, etc. So it is essential that all programs are fully compliant with our flashing images guidelines. That's a mouthful, but it's really interesting. It makes me wonder why U.S. television media outlets don't offer any warnings or screenings aren't harmful video.
I think we get enough warnings as it is. Just that stupid TV PG thing that shows up in the left-hand corner that gets bigger and bigger every year, that's enough. What happens when they air something live? Because oftentimes this is an event where there's lots of cameras flashing, which means it's an important event and oftentimes would be carried live. What happens if you happen to be in the area? Are they going to warn you, in person? Just, I don't know.
Seems to me like the future is digital removal of flash.
Yeah, maybe there's some kind of filter you could install on your TV set for that.
I don't know. I mean, all sorts of people have all sorts of problems with all sorts of things, and I think to warn the entire public about every single possibility is a little bit excessive, and these people should probably take it into their own hands to be careful about this sort of stuff.
You wouldn't say that if you had photosensitive epilepsy.
I was going to say, does this mean we have to get rid of the welcome epileptics flashing sign for hope?
Yeah, Jim, we do. Anyway, some more email here that people have sent to us, oth@2600.com. I did an experiment with my work access RFID card this week. I wrapped it in a few layers of aluminum foil and tested it on the door access receiver. I had to hold the card a bit closer, maybe an inch instead of the usual 2 inches, but it opened the door just fine. Tin foil may shield RFID some, but it doesn't block it. Signed, Florian from Palm Springs, California.
An effective way to block RFID is by putting it in one of those static shielding bags. And in fact, I don't know if this is still true, but when I got my first Easy Pass a bunch of years back, they actually gave it to you with one of those bags so that you could put it in the bag if you didn't want to use it.
So you're going to be charged every time you come near one of the toll booths.
Right.
The power of the transmitter of the RFID detector actually falls off as 1/r². And so there's a lot more power required at 2 inches away than there is at 1 inch away. And you don't realize that, but it's just one of those things. So it's doing a significant amount to shield the RFID. It's just that when you get 1 inch away from the transmitter, you have a significantly higher amount of RF energy than you do at 2 inches away. So.
Okay, another letter. I don't know where else to send this email, so hopefully Off the Hook can help me out. I'm looking to register for the Hope Conference, but I want to know, is there an age limit? I'm 16. Can I still attend?
No.
Yes.
Who said no?
I was denied from attending Linux World because I was 16 once.
Linux World does that.
It
yeah,
sucks.
The corporate conferences do things like that. We do not. You can be 10. As long as you can walk and carry however much money we're asking you to spend to get in. Then you're more than welcome.
It's really not cool when they do that sort of thing.
No.
Because there's no threat involved by having someone young there. It's just,
well, they don't trust young people. Seems pretty obvious. We've had this discussion before on this program, and it's definitely an issue.
If you have CRT-induced epilepsy, you might want to think twice about coming.
Well, we're not going to do the thing Jim said. That was not accurate.
Those of us who don't trust any people really can't make special rules for young people.
Well, they won't be going to Hope.
Yeah, speaking of Hope, we have another Hope meeting at the 2600 meeting this Friday in New York City, so feel free to come on by. It's at the Citigroup Center between the hours of 5 and 8 p.m. in the lobby area. We have all kinds of security, and now we have cops watching us as well. So
not our security, other security.
Well, we have – not our security, no. Although we do have our security people there. If you want to be interested – you want to be part of the Hope security team, come on by because we're always looking for a few good people. Again, 5 to 8 p.m., Citigroup Center, talking about the Hope Conference coming up this July, July 21, 22, and 23. More information, www.hope.net. Dear Off the Hook, I wanted to share a recent cell phone experience with you. I live in British Columbia. I had been with Fido for nearly 2 years. I recently decided to switch to Rogers in order to get the employee pricing plan. I currently work at The Source, which is what Radio Shack turned into here in Canada. When I went to the local Fido store to cancel my phone, I was told they could not do it and had to phone a number. So I did. They were closed for the week. I phoned back the next week, already mad, only to be told that I could not cancel my contract since the account was not in my name. I was under 19 at the time of purchase, so it went into my father's name. When I put my father on the phone, the Fido agent refused to cancel the contract. The reason he gave was that he thought the two of us were scamming the company and we should go to a Fido store. You can see where this will lead me. The issue has yet to be resolved. I'm going to try it again tomorrow. Signed, Jacob from British Columbia. My God. Yeah, that's quite a story.
So some things aren't different in Canada.
No, in fact, some things are even more crazy. And that's
for instance, they have a prime minister who doesn't eat babies.
That is yet to be actually resolved. Mm. Interesting story from one of our listeners locally. I'm a student at Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan. Today we received the attached letter. Basically, we and every other New York City public school are now subject to random searches in which they go through all our belongings and have the right to take MP3 players, cell phones, and basically anything else they feel like taking. under the guise of protecting our security, our rights are being violated. I listen to your show and numerous other RSS syndicated shows on my MP3 player every morning on the way to school and on the way home as well. I don't want this taken away. I'd be grateful if you talked about this on the air because it needs all the attention it can get. Your fan and fellow hacker, Sam. Sam, thanks for writing. The letter basically goes like this. It's from Stanley Keitel, the principal of Stuyvesant High School. Dear parents, we are committed to provide a safe, secure learning environment for all students in our school. The New York City Police Department has assisted us in achieving this goal and in implementing a coordinated approach to school safety. As part of the safety initiative for New York City schools, Mayor Bloomberg has announced that on some days, students will be asked to go through metal scanning machines like the kind used to screen airline passengers for the purpose of detecting weapons. These scanning devices deployed by the NYPD will identify not only weapons, but other objects that are never permitted in our building and will help us to keep everyone safe in our school. The scanning machines will not be at our school every day, but students must be prepared every day to successfully pass through scanners. Students must have their school photo ID and or program card ready and visible before entering the building. Student backpacks, as well as all metal objects, keys, belts, coins, jewelry, etc., will go through the scanner. So if a student places all metal objects in their backpack before reaching the scanner, this will help the line to move quickly. My God, what has happened to schools? There's lines to get into schools. It's like an airport. Students who are not properly prepared for scanning may be required to go through a second handheld scan that will delay their arrival to their first class. Oh, my God, this goes on and on. These days, we often hear that added security measures are a sign of the times. In our school, however, I see this additional security resource as a sign that placing students and staff in a potentially unsafe situation is unacceptable. We must all commit to ensuring the safety of everyone in our community. Wow, times have changed.
This is like a typical typical example of the police or whoever is responsible for this overstepping their bounds, because originally it was for weapons and stuff like that, in which, well, I could understand that in some parts, okay, if you're a student and you actually have to be afraid that a classmate has a weapon or something that, you know, may or may not be used on you, it's maybe understandable. But then to confiscate stuff like portable media players and other electronic devices is really, really ridiculous. There's absolutely no reason for it.
I just want to say, go peg legs.
Well, like Emmanuel, I'm of the age where the most serious thing you could take to school electronically was your transistor radio. But in those days, you could carry it in, but you could not carry it with you. You had to put it in your locker. I hate to disagree with the prevailing trend here, but you're underage or close to underage. The school is not a democracy. If they tell you you can't bring it in, don't bring it in.
Yeah, but it's stupid.
Well, which is
that's
stupid?
That's the point I'm trying to make here.
Which part is stupid?
Well, I mean, why are MP3 players
they're a distraction in class.
When you're walking to school or walking back from school?
That's what I say. Why not be, you should be allowed to put it in your locker if you have a locker.
Well, you can't get into the locker without going through the metal detector.
Kind of stupid.
It's very stupid.
Whereas cell phones, the argument is that they're a disruption. If they ring, if they don't ring, they can be used for cheating. And they tell you you're not supposed to carry them. The counter argument from students and parents is, what if there's another 9/11 and whatever? Well, hello. Like I said before, Emmanuel and I are from the transistor radio era. They still have payphones. There are plenty of them around Stuyvesant. I know where it is, West Chambers Street. You can always use a payphone.
Yeah, but you see, you can use these sign of the times arguments to basically push any agenda. Okay, sign of the times. We now have Columbines and people shooting up schools all the time. Okay, so that means people should have cell phones on them in case they're in a hostage situation somewhere so they can call out, you know, and to keep our kids safe, let's make sure they have cell phones. To keep our kids safe, let's make sure they can listen to music.
No, to keep our kids safe.
And calm their nerves.
Let them have satellite phones. That's better because in a 9/11.
Satellite phones?
Yeah. In a 9/11 situation, every cell tower nearby is going to collapse when they hijack 500 panes and
go to
the building.
What if it's space aliens? Then they're going to shoot out the satellites.
Well, carry both. Or even better, have quarters for the cell payphones.
Gone on enough.
You know, if only one person had a satellite phone on the island of Lost, that show would never have even gotten off the ground. Just something to point out.
Well, it's fiction. I'd like to point out that they wrote it so that no one had a satellite phone.
Based on fact.
It's based on fact. Stop.
Look it up. All right. We're going to take phone calls. 212-209-2900 is our phone number. Again, write to us, oth@2600.com. Our snail mail address, off the hook, care of WBAI, 120 Wall Street.
10th floor.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You totally just...
You can have the first city name.
New York.
10005.
I'm sorry. It's the first time I ever messed it up. Okay, we'll take the phone calls as soon as they start pouring
in. So messing it up is defined as giving the correct address.
Yeah.
Okay.
from the wrong...
Just wanted to make sure I understood.
Yeah. A couple other letters. Obviously, we have a whole bunch coming in, and we do like to read as many as we can. But you know what? I think we should take phone calls because we have a lot of those, and we only have a few minutes left. Let's go over here. Good evening. You're on the air.
I noticed there are a lot of payphones being removed at restaurants.
That's because you use them too much and they don't like you hanging around. Good evening. You're on the air. All right. Hopefully he hasn't called us 25 times tonight. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hey. Hi, everyone.
How you doing?
I just want to speak really quickly on the metal detectors in the school.
Go ahead.
I actually went to – the last I've been in school was like 94, and they were doing that back then. I don't think it's much of a big difference now.
Well, okay. You know, it's been 10 years then or – 12 years or 15 years, who knows?
Yeah, I think what it is, I mean, you know, I don't want to pull a race card or anything, but exactly where is this Stuyvesant High School? Is it like a predominantly white school or?
Well, what's your theory?
My theory is it's not really a theory. It's just that it's actually been around in like more of where the inner city kids would go to school. I mean, you know, it's been the norm, like I said, for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that now people are. Well, students are yelling and screaming now because it's actually hitting other schools now, like maybe private schools and other, you know.
Well, Stuyvesant is a one of the upper schools of the city. It's the one everyone tries to get into. But, you know, I see this as this is a citywide thing. This is happening everywhere. And, yeah, maybe it happened in some places first.
The caller is correct in that in a lot of schools in sort of the outer boroughs, which is equivalent to the inner city. I never understood that term. They've had these for a long time.
Yeah, it's been implicated for as long as I can remember.
Stuyvesant is actually located near the former World Trade Center in Manhattan, and it's a specialized school for science and math students that you need to take a test to get into.
Isn't Stuyvesant predominantly non-white, ironically?
I wouldn't know right now.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Well, anyway, why are we unprotected when we go into malls? I went to a shopping mall the other day, and, you know, nobody checked me for weapons. I could have been carrying a whole arsenal of weapons. I could have been carrying all kinds of cell phones and MP3 players, too, but that's beside the point. Do we not care about the people in malls? Our children go to malls, you know.
Malls,
do we not care about our kids when they're in malls?
Malls are only a couple stories high, so the odds of you toppling
it over.
Well, let me finish. The odds of you toppling it over are slim. Malls also tend to have large expanses inside so people can run away. So the odds of you killing a large amount of people with one suicide belt are also very slim. All right, you need something like nerve gas.
I don't think there's been many suicide bombers in schools. I think they're more concerned with people carrying weapons of various sorts.
Right, but malls are big. People can run away. You're not going to kill a lot of them.
Suicide bombers are
run
in
away.
Malls. What are you talking about?
Where?
In Israel, they have suicide bombers in malls.
Well, they're years ahead of us.
Well,
all right. Let's try to take another phone call. Good evening. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, wow, I got on.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm calling from Montreal.
Oh, cool, Montreal.
Yeah, and I just want to say I have proof that Stephen Harper does, in fact, eat babies.
Well, this is what we've been looking for.
Make sure you send that to us.
Yeah, also about the school thing, I don't know. I remember 10 years ago being in high school, and they'd keep us in the classrooms, and police would come. We couldn't come into the hallways. And they'd come with dogs to sniff for marijuana and various sort of illegal things also. So I don't think this is necessarily a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, and definitely I'd be careful of saying that you can go into a mall carrying, whatever, because just, you know, as early as tomorrow, they'll go all crazy in America and they'll be searching you there too.
Well, do you think nobody has ever thought of this before? I mean, it's so simple to do these things. I've got news for people. You can blow things up. You can kill people. You can shoot people. It's very easy to do. And when I went to school, it wasn't, you know, an incredibly long time ago. I guess it was long enough ago. you were able to just walk into the building and walk out. You could walk into the building even if you didn't go to school there, and people didn't freak out. What's changed? What's happened to us?
I'm very interested in receiving the proof that Stephen Harper eats babies.
Yes, you know where to send that. Send that to the Dropbox in the place by
could,
the thing.
Could be a different Stephen Harper.
No, not likely. Not likely. Let's see if we can take another one. Good evening. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, gentlemen.
No problem. It was
really
my pleasure.
Enjoy the show. Could you answer the question? Back in 2001, was it and is it now possible to make a cellular phone call from an airplane 30, 25,000 feet?
I'll leave Bernie to answer this call. Go ahead, Bernie.
It's spotty. You might succeed that high. It's unlikely you're going to get a call through at that altitude, but it's possible. It really depends on a lot of variables, propagation, where, you know, whether you're sitting on a side of a window, on a window side of the plane where it's close to a city that has a large population and lots of cell sites. You know, the 9/11 people on Flight 93 and so forth that made phone calls, they were at a decent altitude, probably like 20,000 feet, and they were able to make calls, supposedly. So you just have to try it and find out.
And a lot of, actually, if you saw the movie recently that just came out about that flight, they were all making phone calls on the air phones, not actually their cell phones.
Okay, one more call really quick. Good evening. You're on the air. Go ahead, make it quick.
Hi, how you doing? Real quick, I heard last week that there was a place in Colorado that a guy had bought a strobe light that was triggering all the traffic lights.
Yes.
Did you hear anything about that?
Yeah, we reported on this. It was a guy who was basically wanted to get to work faster, so he made all the lights green for himself. And I think he only got a $25 fine for this.
Oh, wow.
It's a pretty silly technology. It's very easy to apparently defeat.
The thing is called an opticon, so you may want to do a search for that.
Okay, we are out of time. I want to thank everybody for calling in. Remind people the meetings are taking place all around the world this Friday, and the Hope Coordination meeting taking place here in New York at the Citigroup Center between 5 and 8 p.m. www.hope.net for more information. We're going to do something that we did last week, too. And the reason we're playing the same song as yesterday on Off the Wall is because so many people reacted to our playing of it there. This is something new from Neil Young, which hopefully will become something akin to an anthem. We'll see. Have a good night. See you next week.
Yes, yeah. Ooh, that was great. That goes out to the cat and all that other stuff I'm supposed to say. You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. I'm back from Miami. And-